This is the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Once a year, we decorate our homes with fake skeletons and tombstones for one spooky celebration. That day is today, Halloween. But after this day, once again, death becomes a taboo topic. Tanya Marsh wants to change that. She's a law professor at Wake Forest University, and she teaches what is likely the nation's only course on funeral and cemetery law. She also hosts the podcast Death et Sec. We're continuing our series Embodied today, conversations about sex, relationships, and your health. And we are talking about our relationship with death and the dead. Tanya, welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we said likely the nation's only course on funeral and cemetery law right here in North Carolina. How exciting. What got you into this? Why are you the only one?
Well, those are sort of two separate questions. So I've always been interested in cemeteries. I did genealogy back when I was in high school and college, so before I became a lawyer. And, you know, cemeteries are a particular kind of real property, and I'm a commercial real estate lawyer. I practiced for 10 years before coming to Wake Forest. So I started getting into this whole area by just learning more about cemetery law, and then I realized it was just this whole onion, the relationship between cemeteries and the funeral industry and trying to understand the law and business of each of those. So it's not real surprising that it's the only class of its kind in the country, because this is really sort of a neglected area of the law. And I think it's just that death taboo that you mentioned in the lead-in extends to the law too.
So what are some of the laws in North Carolina that intrigue you that people may not know about?
Well, I don't know that North Carolina is really pretty typical. I think that one thing that surprises people when I start to bore them by telling them about specific laws is that the funeral industry itself is pretty highly regulated in a lot of ways that maybe we wouldn't expect it to be. So our behavior in terms of treating the dead prior to their disposition, their final disposition, is perhaps more constrained than Americans are used to having our behavior constrained. But then after death, the law regarding cemeteries is incredibly wide open. So I think people have a lot of ideas like, oh, you're burying, caskets 6 foot deep. Well, no, we don't bury caskets anywhere near that depth. And there's very few laws telling us how to run cemeteries or what goes on in them. And in fact, we have tons of cemeteries in North Carolina that aren't regulated by the state at all. Only for-profit cemeteries are regulated by the state.
Well, that's interesting, because in recent years, there's been a lot of news stories about finding cemeteries kind of under these existing spaces, or finding areas where there are a lot of unmarked graves. So what's behind that?
Well, so there's no requirement, and there's never been a requirement that you have to mark a grave. So we have sort of these a couple of different ideas that are in tension with one another and create some practical problems. So one is the idea, and this is throughout U.S. cemetery law and dates all the way back to Roman law, that once you put a dead body in the ground, it sort of fundamentally changes the nature of that real property. And that real property is dedicated to that person's remains in perpetuity. I mean, forever. And in fact, the remains and the soil sort of merge in this legal way. And then in the United States, the dead have rights. The dead have the right to a decent burial, and then they have a right to an undisturbed, again, perpetual repose. So you have these really strong rights, and then you have some duties and obligations put on the living in order to protect them. But if you don't put physical traces of the graves on the top of the ground, like a tombstone, like a big sign that says cemetery or record a deed or, you know, something to alert the living to their presence, people can forget, right? I mean, families die out or they move on, and we forget rather quickly. And so then you can uncover bodies as part of construction or farming or, you know, natural disasters. And that unfortunately happens all the time. So we have this real ongoing tension between these real strict, rigid protections of the dead and then the practical reality that we don't always live up to that.
That's so interesting, because there's also a tension there that you're illuminating between the dead and the families that survive them. And there are so many interesting examples that you give in your podcast of these, you know, people that leave what they think is a very clear explanation of what they want to happen with them in their will. And then they die, and it turns out all of this confusion erupts, and sometimes their bodies sit for, you know, 2, 3, 4 months kind of in limbo. Right. So what, like, how does that happen?
Well, so in North Carolina, like in many states, a person can leave specific instructions about what they want to have happen to their remains after their death. And pre-planning is, I think, always a really good idea as part of estate planning to think about what you want your funeral and disposition to be. Because it is a really emotional time for the surviving members of the family. And, you know, it's in some cases, it's sort of their last opportunity to fight about whatever it is that they've been fighting about. Dysfunctional families, this is their last opportunity to express that dysfunction, you know. So it puts, you know, funeral directors in a pretty bad position. The law, for example, let's say there's no surviving spouse, they tend to have top priority over arranging, you know, funeral and disposition. Let's say there's no surviving spouse and there's 3 surviving children. And maybe 2 of the kids agree and one of them's estranged, or all 3 of them are on different pages. Funeral director doesn't want to sit there and have to be the person to mediate disputes, right, about who did daddy love more, which is expressed then in how are we going to do this funeral and who's going to be calling the shots. So you can see how these sort of disputes can arise. And it's because the law, you know, sort of sets up a framework for who's going to be in control to make these decisions, but doesn't really have great, like, tie-breaking mechanisms. Yeah, like you mentioned, I mean, sometimes bodies will end up in the refrigerator at the funeral home for a couple of months while the courts are sorting out who's going to win these disputes.
Well, there's also an interesting dispute that has to do with the story of the Boston Marathon bomber. Will you tell me that story? And it raises a ton of interesting questions about kind of the rights of people that we may deem as evil.
Sure. So Tsarnaev, died while being pursued by the police. And he was in the United States legally. I believe he was a citizen, but in any regard, he was in the United States legally and died in Massachusetts. Well, he had a spouse in the United States, but I guess she didn't take any responsibility for his remains. So it was his uncle that came in from the former Soviet Union who took control of his body, and there was sort of no dispute about that. A funeral home agreed to handle his remains, but then when they went looking for a cemetery in Massachusetts that would give him a burial in accordance with Muslim law, every cemetery said, no, we're not going to handle his remains. And so it ended up that then there were protesters outside the funeral home. I mean, it was a sort of a day-to-day kind of breathless thing in the papers and in the media in the Boston area about what's going to happen to Tsarnaev's remains. And people are like, send him back to Russia, which is not really a thing because he's not even from Russia.
Oh, yeah.
Or go, you know, take him on a boat and dump him in the ocean the way they did with bin Laden. And, you know, what lots of very creative solutions to this problem. And eventually the family just sort of snuck him out of the Boston area in the middle of the night. And he ended up being buried in accordance with Muslim tradition, an unmarked grave in a cemetery in Virginia.
Wow.
Which then the next day that hit the papers, because in Massachusetts, when you record the death certificate, you have to indicate the place of final disposition. So they had to indicate the cemetery in Virginia. And then the sheriff in that county in Virginia, nobody had told him, because people don't call the sheriff when you're bringing a dead body in to be buried in a cemetery in the sheriff's county. I mean, that just would be a ridiculous thing to call the sheriff. But the sheriff found out about it from the newspapers, and then he starts sort of putting up a fuss about how he'd like to have him disinterred and sent back to Massachusetts. But that didn't really go anywhere.
So
nobody wanted Tsarnaev.
Yeah, and it gets really complicated. So as things are changing culturally a little bit, there are more cremations. There are people that are really concerned about the environmental impact of funeral methods, kind of this rise in green burial. Talk about some of this transition and how that is changing things for the law, or kind of that relationship there between culture and law.
Sure. So we had really single-digit cremation rates in the United States until about the 1980s. And then I believe it was 2015 that our cremation rate actually exceeded the burial rate in the United States. So that is an enormous amount of cultural change in a very short period of time, to go from, you know, really about 0% in the 60s, single digits in the 80s, to more than half of all deaths in the United States in 2015 resulted in cremation. And so there's a couple of different things driving that. But it's, as you mentioned, there's an increased interest in environmentalism the tradition, quote unquote, traditional burial with embalming and then a steel casket and a concrete vault is perceived by many people to be very consumptive and sort of anti-environmentalist. And then also, I think that there's this really strong thread of consumers wanting to have more control over sort of fundamental life activities that they once excluded from the personal sphere, right? So it's sort of an interest in controlling your own funeral and disposition is, I think, similar to wanting to go to a farmer's market on a Saturday, right? Where we outsource death the same way we outsourced caring for the sick and, you know, food production and everything else. And then you've seen in many of those spheres of American life, renewed interest in home births is sort of the other end of the spectrum of it, right? Is a renewed interest in sort of recapturing those activities and bringing them back under personal control. So cremation just allows, I think, a lot more, or it's perceived to allow a lot more flexibility in terms of family control over the funeral and the disposition. But then there's also these emerging technologies. There's alkaline hydrolysis, which is also known as aquamation, which is basically dissolving the body in a very base solution and some agitation and water. So that's perceived to be even greener than flame cremation. That's not available in North Carolina yet. And then the one that I'm really excited about was just legalized in Washington State by my friend Katrina Spade and her company Recompose. And it's basically, they're calling it accelerated natural decomposition. It's basically composting people. So that's the most green options that's hopefully coming down the street for more of us.
Well, let's put the United States into a more global picture. My family is from India, and I've been to one Indian burial, which is kind of you take this boat out into the Ganges and you dump ashes into the Ganges. And it's such an interesting scene because there are a lot of kind of lower income kids who are there who immediately die for the gold and the jewelry and everything that is dumped alongside the body. So at once, it's this really sacred family moment. And then on the other side, this kind of like everyone on the same playing field, people are quickly absorbing the gold and all these materials that have to do with the death. So it's kind of an absurd, it's both absurd and spiritual at the same time. And it strikes me as really different from any experiences I've had in the U.S. So I'm curious to hear your take on kind of how we compare it to other places in the world.
Well, you know, a lot of different cultures have their own sort of death rituals and that are very specific to their religious beliefs and also to their cultural development. I will say, you know, Americans, what we would call the American way of death, which is you go to the funeral, the funeral home comes and takes the body right after death from, I mean, we treat it like a public health emergency, even though it really isn't, but that's what we tend to do. The body's taken to the funeral home, it's embalmed. You have an open casket viewing in the funeral home, and then you buy a wood or metal casket, and about 70% of caskets in the United States are metal, made of steel, like auto-grade steel, and then go out to the cemetery where there's a concrete box sunk in the grave, place the casket in the box, you have a graveside service, and we're done. That's the American way of death, and we think of that as, well, you know, we just sort of take it for granted, right, that this is what everybody does it. Nobody in the world does it this way,
yeah.
Except for a couple of countries where they're starting to sort of copy us. But, you know, countries like India, many places in Asia, many places in Western Europe have nearly 100% cremation rates. So there's a huge change right there.
Do you think the way... go ahead.
Yeah, go. No, I was just going to say you also have grave recycling in many parts of the world. So this idea that we're going to occupy a single grave in perpetuity is sort of, you know, an American idea because we just had so much land, right? But places where land is much more precious, you're going to get a lease for 15 to maybe 50 years. Then after that period of time, they're going to dig out whatever hasn't decomposed yet, put that into a communal or mass grave, and then re-let the space to somebody else. So we think that everybody does it this way, and really nobody does it this way.
Well, it's almost like the way that we do it here creates this kind of psychic disruption because the body is seen immediately as something like scary and a health hazard, and then it's just has to do with the family. and their private engagement versus kind of that scene I was describing in India now as I'm thinking about it. It right. kind of becomes this community experience unintentionally because everyone is at the river for a variety of reasons and they're right. all happen to then be witness to this. So I don't know. Do you think that there's some kind of psychic disruption?
Yeah, I mean, it's this self-reinforcing cycle, right? So, I mean, we, you know, I probably all four of my grandparents who were all born in the early 1900s, they took part in funerals that happened at home. That was routine. Everybody did that. And it's really only been since about World War II that in the United States we've had, you know, throughout the United States, the kinds of cultural traditions that we have today. So the more that you take an activity and you take it outside of your everyday experience, the more you isolate it and then leave it in the hands of experts, which would be the, you know, the funeral industry, then the more illiterate we become about how to deal with it ourselves and the more taboo the subject can become. So, I mean, the scene that you were describing was, you know, in a very practical, messy way, that's kind of woven into the fabric of life, right? Death is part of the fabric of life. And death in the United States is not woven into the fabric of life. It is disruptive. It is traumatic. It breaks all of our patterns, right? So, yeah, I think psychically, it's definitely.
Definitely a disruption
a
there.
We're a little messed up, yeah.
All right. Well, Tanya Marsh is a law professor at Wake Forest University and hosts the podcast Death at SEC. Thank you, Tanya, and happy Halloween.
Thank you. You too.
You can find out more about the show, her podcast, and everything we talked about today, as well as the rest of our Embodied series, all of that at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hall of Mormon. Robin Copley is the technical director. Josie Taurus also produced today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.